Surface coal mining leaves behind dry, rocky soil that's not good for much. Except, it turns out, growing lavender.
A year ago, I'd have laughed at you if you'd have told me they were on farm on a strip job. But these plants seem to be doing real good in it.
I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, how turning fields purple with lavender could earn some green for coal country. And President Trump wants to expand offshore drilling. But it's an unpopular proposal for environmentalists and fishermen alike.
You're going to have more ship traffic, more accidental spills of various chemicals as they drill into the sediment.
Plus, we learn a couple of moves from a unique winter sports enthusiast.
I love the fact that I'm out here in fresh air on top of the snow, being able to twirl around.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. A natural gas well operated by a subsidiary of ExxonMobil exploded last week in eastern Ohio. People near the area were still evacuated from their homes more than a week later as natural gas and salty brine poured from the site. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports the cause of the blowout is still unknown.
Sarah Longsmith lives in Powhatan Point near XTO Energy's Schnegg well. An explosion at the pad led to fires that lasted 3 days and a continued gas leak. There were no injuries. A Belmont County emergency management official says they evacuated a one-mile radius around the pad. Longsmith and her husband live further from the site and were told they were being evacuated. They spent 2 nights at a hotel. Longsmith can still hear the leak, a low sound in the distance.
It's eerie. You just wonder what's happening, and if it's still escaping, then it's in the air.
XTO spokesperson Karen Matusik says the well was one of four on the pad and was almost in production. XTO is working with a well control crew from Texas to plug it.
Right now, we are still clearing debris, and currently we're following a methodical process to safely address the integrity of an adjacent well on the same pad site.
Matusik says after the explosion, a construction crane ended up on top of one of the working wells, and that's slowing down their ability to cap the leaking well.
We think it's laying on top of it, so they need to move that.
Matusik says rain has been slowing progress. The company doesn't know how much gas is leaking or how much cleanup will cost. State and federal regulators are monitoring air quality around the site and at nearby homes. Four are still evacuated. Regulators have also set up floating booms in nearby Captina Creek to protect it from salty brine water that's also pouring from the well. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Fishermen, environmentalists, realtors, and business owners descended on a hotel near Trenton this month, voicing their unified opposition to drilling for oil and natural gas off the coast of New Jersey. The public meeting hosted by federal officials came as the Trump administration has proposed opening up the entire East Coast to offshore exploration. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports the proposal has little support.
At the Fisherman's Co-op in Point Pleasant, New Jersey, about half a dozen men sort freshly caught scup, or porgies, into bins.
Do I get paid for this?
Jim Lovegren is the captain of the Shadowfax.
These fish will all get put in a cooler by tonight. 30, 40,000 pounds of fish on the dock today. They'll all be on their way to New York, Philadelphia, sometimes Baltimore. We ship anywhere from Canada down past North Carolina.
Lovegren is a fourth-generation fisherman and grew up here trawling the waters off Sandy Hook. He's seen changes from rising ocean temperatures.
Blackback flounders are just about extinct in this area here. That was a major fisher. Yellowtail flounders, codfish, lobsters are disappearing off of Jersey, and it's all because the water's getting too warm.
Lovegren knows burning fossil fuels is connected to climate change, warming oceans, and his disappearing fish. Still, he says he needs fossil fuel to trawl the ocean floor.
I own a fishing boat. It runs on diesel fuel. You have to have energy.
But Trump's offshore drilling proposal is an immediate threat he's gearing up to fight.
You start putting a bunch of oil rigs out there. One, it takes away places we can tow, okay, where we can fish. the main concern is an oil spill, you know.
Talk to anyone who makes their living along the Jersey Shore, whether it's selling saltwater taffy or renting shore houses, and they'll tell you about the 2010 Deepwater Horizon drilling rig explosion off the coast of Louisiana. That's when an estimated 168 million gallons of oil spilled into the Gulf of Mexico, decimating the fisheries and driving away tourists.
If you had a Deepwater Horizon spill down in Delaware, it's going to come right up off of Jersey. It's going to wash right into Long Island, onto the beach. Could be hitting Cape Cod and Nantucket.
Lofgren voted for President Trump, and he still supports him, but not his proposal. He worries seismic testing, which is used to find the oil and gas reserves, would hurt whales and dolphins. He's also concerned about potential smaller leaks that don't make headlines. And he's not alone.
Just sort of the industrialization, you might say, of the coastal area would have an impact to the fisheries. You're going to have more ship traffic, more accidental spills of various chemicals as they drill into the sediment.
David Valinsky is vice president for science at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. He says a spill along the eastern seaboard could have even greater impact on the coastal ecosystem than the Deepwater Horizon did in the Gulf. That's because the Gulf of Mexico already has natural oil seeps.
So that system has adapted to having those hydrocarbons in the water already. Here on the East Coast, we don't have those natural seeps, as they call it. So the system, it would be more of a shock to the system than it would have been in the Gulf.
Politicians on both sides of the aisle are also lining up to fight this proposal. Only one East Coast governor, Maine's Paul LePage, supports it. But beyond 3 miles offshore, the ocean belongs to the federal government. The last time drilling occurred off the coast of New Jersey was in the early 1980s, when oil companies explored about 80 miles east of Atlantic City. It was short-lived. They decided there just wasn't enough oil to justify the cost. But the industry says improved technology means it's worth exploring today. Jim Benton is the executive director of the New Jersey Petroleum Council, which says oil rigs could bring thousands of jobs and millions of tax dollars to the state. And Benton says drilling rigs and fishing already coexist.
You go up to Nova Scotia, you go up to Newfoundland. Those are places where tremendous deposits have been found and energy is being produced today.
Benton says spills like the Deepwater Horizon are rare.
After that unfortunate accident, we did establish a research facility that really brought about some major changes along with federal regulations to undertake a comprehensive safety review.
But back in Point Pleasant, Jim Lofgren says he's not convinced.
I don't see it. I have solar. I've had solar on my house for 6 years. I love it. And this is where we should be going.
Why do you love it?
Because my electric is a third of what it used to be. I think every building, every house in this country should have solar power.
Lofgren knows solar won't provide the horsepower he needs to operate his boat. But he says drilling off the Jersey Shore is just not worth the risk. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Ski ballet is a whole thing. It's skiing downhill with choreography and a lot of individual style. So when you're just starting out,
the main thing is you learn all the rules on how to ski properly, and then you break them.
Later on the Allegheny Front, a lesson in ski ballet from someone who's still falling for it more than 40 years later. Stay tuned. Another Trump administration decision that had people concerned last summer was their intention to scrap the Clean Power Plan. That's the Obama-era policy to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from electrical power generation, mostly existing coal plants, by 32% by 2030, below 2005 levels. But researchers at Carnegie Mellon University found that the Clean Power Plan might actually be less important than we thought. They looked at emissions data from the government's 2017 annual energy outlook and found that the U.S. can still meet or maybe even beat its emissions reduction targets without the Clean Power Plan. How? I asked Paul Fischbeck, a professor in engineering and public policy and social and decision sciences.
Well, it turns out that the emissions from power generation has decreased considerably over the last 5-8 years. from 2.7 billion tons down to an estimated 1.9 billion tons. So that's a very significant decrease. A major factor in this reduction is the low price of natural gas and the natural market forces that allow natural gas to replace some of the coal generation.
But if I'm understanding your study correctly, natural gas could help us get to these targets that we want to get to in the short term, but not necessarily in the long term.
Well, based on our study, we've already achieved the 2025 goal for carbon emissions from power generation today already. So we're 8 years ahead of where we wanted to be with the Clean Power Plan. That's a very significant sort of change in the playing field. What about 2030? The goals that the Clean Power Plan had set for 2030, can those be achieved without any other interventions? Or how can they be achieved if the price of natural gas goes up? And these are the policy questions that we are researching now.
During the Obama administration, natural gas was called a bridge fuel to lower emissions and to get a cleaner energy scenario that would include eventually more renewable energy. Natural gas is still a fossil fuel. It has its own greenhouse gas issues, methane, which is released when it's extracted. Are you suggesting we should rely on natural gas in the long term?
The questions are 10, 15, 20 years from now, what is the technology for generating electricity going to be? If you back up 10 years, no one had forecast this revolution of natural gas prices. And so to go forward 10 years, there could be equivalent or more significant technological breakthroughs that would allow us to do things in a very different way. So there are a whole range of new technologies, for instance, small modular reactors, SMRs, which are nuclear power plants that are much smaller and more efficient and potentially safer, that could be distributed in a variety of different places. If that technology, which is now just beginning, were to really meet its stride, it could replace lots and lots of generation. Likewise, the price for renewables is also coming down. And so it could very well be that renewables now become more competitive. And if we get a battery technology breakthrough, which allows us to store that renewable electricity, then it's a game changer.
One of the reasons that renewable energy has become more affordable is because of tax credits. If the federal government or the EPA isn't mandating a switch or some kind of conversion or incentive for more renewable energy with regulation like the Clean Power Plan, how else might that be accomplished? Are market forces enough?
Well, this is always the big complaint between the two sides. If the government is providing subsidies for renewables, they're tipping the balance of the in the marketplace towards one side. Is that a good idea? It has both pluses and minuses. One of the problems that's happened is with these tax credits, they tend to come and go based on year to year. And it's very hard for renewable generators to make long-term plans. You know, a wind farm has to be built by December 31st or it loses its tax credit. And it may not reappear in the next year or the year after. So how do you start to account for making business decisions when you have this politically adjustable tax credits that are occurring? So if you can rely more on the marketplace, it is perhaps more predictable.
But it sounds like, though, if gas prices stay low, that why wouldn't you just continue to rely on natural gas?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be the case. Natural gas has surpassed coal now for generation. Natural gas has about half the carbon emissions that coal does. And we're seeing this in Pennsylvania, where they're taking power plants that used to burn coal, and they're being converted to burn natural gas. This trend will continue if the natural gas prices stay low. But here's another government factor that could, in fact, creep in. What if we start to sell our natural gas overseas? Well, that's going to make the price of natural gas in Japan and Europe go down, but the price of natural gas in the United States would go up. What would the impact of that be on the market? And that's a big, big factor that's pending in the future.
I would imagine that a lot of environmentalists would look at your study and think, oh, this is dangerous. This sounds to me like we don't need to do anything.
Well, that's not what we're saying. We're saying is that we have to consider the entire system that includes the marketplace and regulation and subsidies and how those all interact with each other. the lower prices of natural gas, in part to fracking, has reshuffled the deck as to what options are available in the future for us to attain various carbon emission goals. And having more options allows you to perhaps make better decisions. More options is good, not bad.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Paul Fischbeck is a professor in engineering and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University. The CMU study was published in Environmental Science and Technology, and there's a link at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holzapfel. When you think about mountaintop coal mining in Appalachia, you can just picture the devastation of the landscape. But what if you could see something else? Imagine those barren mountains covered with purple fields of lavender. That change might be coming because some people in West Virginia think growing lavender could give the state's struggling economy a boost. As part of the series Appalachian Innovators, West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Roxy Todd has the story.
I'm standing on land in Boone County that looks like a moonscape, with parched gray dirt and jagged blasted-off mountaintops in the distance. Donnie Facemeyer is a laid-off coal miner. He helped strip this mountain back when he was working for Pritchard Mining.
A year ago, I'd have laughed at you if you'd have told me they were on farm on a strip job because it's all just shot rock. But these plants seem to be doing real good in it.
These lavender plants are little more than scrawny bushes now, barely a foot tall. But Facemeyer is hoping this mountaintop will soon be turned into fields of purple. He's one of the farmers taking part in a new project launched by the West Virginia Regional Technology Park in Kanawha County to grow lavender on former strip mines. Turns out, the plants actually thrive in the dry, rocky soil that surface mining leaves behind. This job is what's keeping Facemeyer and his family from leaving the state.
Me and my wife were going to until I ran into this job. We were going south. Going to sell everything we own and take off. Start all over.
Like Facemeyer, other new farmers are hoping the lavender industry can provide a steady source of income to support them in West Virginia. It's a new industry here in Appalachia, but the idea was enticing to a handful of people who signed up for a training class, even some who moved to West Virginia for the program. Some came from Texas, others from Ohio. One family came from Florida. Sky Ritchie and his wife, Deborah, say a fellow veteran told them about the Lavender Project, and so they sold everything they owned and moved to the Mountain State.
Came up here as the veteran program to learn how to grow lavender. Everybody loves it. We moved up here to turn a new chapter in our lives.
As part of the program, the Ritchies get paid an education stipend of $10 an hour for the 6 weeks they spend learning about lavender and how to grow it. The program is called Green Mining, and it's just getting started. Last year, it received a $1 million grant from the Appalachian Regional Commission's Power Initiative, which helped pay for salaries and student stipends. But can it work? We reached out to more than a dozen lavender farmers across the United States, and each told a similar story. It's a lot of fun and a great way to earn a small side income. But only two farmers, both in Washington State, said they make a full-time living from lavender alone. Shelly Keeney has a small lavender farm in her backyard in Huntington, West Virginia. It's a peaceful place. The scent of lavender wafts through the air.
I have about 100 lavender plants, a little over that. And I do pretty well with it. But as far as having a full-time business, I would probably have to have, let's say, 10 acres at least to just solely do lavender.
The plants Keeney has keep her busy enough, especially since she also has a full-time job. Inside her garage, she has a small workshop. Fresh lavender hangs from the wooden beams to dry. Keeney shows me the jams and jellies she sells at farmers markets.
This one is a strawberry jam with just a hint of lavender. You don't want to overpower anything that you use lavender in that you're going to eat for culinary purposes. And this is great on scones and biscuits.
She says she gets requests from farmers markets across West Virginia, way more than she has time for. One product that's in especially high demand is essential oil.
And maybe it's our busy lives and we all need to calm down a little bit. So people are looking for ways to help them calm down, and lavender's going to do it.
The coordinators for the Green Mining Lavender Project want to tap into the essential oil aromatherapy industry too, but they'll need to produce at least 2,000 gallons of oil to sell to the larger companies. At the Green Mining headquarters in South Charleston, a former Dow Chemical coal testing lab has been transformed into a distillation station for lavender. Project coordinator Marina Sawyer says Green Mining is prepared to meet demand. They want Appalachia to be the new home for USA-sourced lavender oil.
Unless you buy locally grown or something that was made out of Washington, then it's probably from overseas, because that's where most of the lavender comes from. It hasn't been that big a crop in the U.S. before.
Lavender could bring in some revenue to southern West Virginia, but it's unlikely to bring back the thousands of coal jobs that have disappeared in the past decade. West Virginia's chief economist, John Deskins, says that although coal production has bounced back some,
still far down from where it was a few years ago. So ultimately in the state, we desperately need to diversify our economic mix.
He says what the state's economy desperately needs now is more innovators, people who will try out new business ideas.
Because nobody knows for sure, right? People like me study the economy, other government officials study the economy. We try to figure out what might have potential, what might not have potential, but ultimately it's up to an entrepreneur to experiment, and they'll find what works and what doesn't work.
Back up at the Boone County Strip Mine, the students in the program are busy planting baby lavender plants. One man is drilling holes with an electric rototiller. Retired Army officer James Ross is helping troubleshoot a problem the crew had yesterday. They accidentally planted in the wrong area. Now they have to go back and replant the crop. Ross is one of the program instructors. In the Army, he led missions for a battalion of 11,000 people. Now he's channeling that energy into teaching West Virginians to farm.
Now, have we got 100% solution right now on helping the state's economic problems? No, I'm not saying that. But it's the right step forward. It's the right step forward to taking this unusable land and using it for something good.
Not everyone has stuck with the program. Last summer, 16 people signed up for the class, but only half completed it. The second course had 20 graduates. Many of the trainees say they'll grow lavender on a strip mine, especially if they're able to lease the land for cheap. The coordinators with the Green Mining Program say they're applying for another federal grant to help them transition to a co-op model. If they succeed, the lavender farmers would be the owners of the entire business and operation within 3 years. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Roxy Todd in Boone County, West Virginia.
That story comes to us from our partners at West Virginia Public Broadcasting and their Appalachian Innovator Series. There's more at wvpublic.org.
Red roses too, I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Center for Environmental Research and Education at Duquesne University, now celebrating 25 years of preparing environmental professionals. The center provides multidisciplinary education for careers in environmental science and management with opportunities for research and internships. Programs include a BS in environmental science, master's in environmental science and management, and professional certificate programs. More information on the Center for Environmental Research and Education can be found at duq.edu/ESM.
Picture ballet, figure skating, and skiing all mashed into one. That's ski ballet, a mostly forgotten art form. It got a little glory as a demonstration sport in the 1988 and 92 Olympic Games, but interest in it quickly waned when ski ballet didn't become a medal event. Well, on the slopes of Hidden Valley Resort south of Pittsburgh, ski ballet is being kept alive by one very enthusiastic early adopter. The Allegheny Front's Andy Cubis has more.
It's hard to describe ski ballet until you've seen it.
Here comes George building up speed for his first big maneuver. Oh, a 2.5 stay cross. That was fabulous.
Picture a choreographed routine of flips, rolls, and twirls, set to music while the skier glides down the slope in costume.
Would you look at those sleeves on his outfit? He is really one dramatic skier.
I saw it on television and I said, whoa, they're doing this on skis, and how do they do that?
This is Ed Cook, and when he saw ski ballet for the first time in 1976, he knew he had to try it. He went out and bought himself a pair of ballet skis, just a little shorter than a regular downhill pair, and it quickly became his passion.
I love the fact that I'm out here in the fresh air on top of the snow, being able to twirl around and just get the thrill of it all. It's wonderful, absolutely wonderful.
Now, 1 month shy of 67, you can find him most winter weekends on the slopes of the ski resort practicing his art, but in jeans, no costume.
The main thing is you learn all the rules on how to ski properly, and then you break them. What I do is I tend to lift my left leg and bring the ski up towards my shoulder, and then I will start to make 360s on the ground.
Cook starts to propel himself into a circle, using his poles to guide him. At one point, he's skiing backwards. It's surprising how often you see the bottom of his skis. He looks like a pinwheel.
And then at one point, I bring the tip of the ski back down, have the tip cross over my other ski, catch the snow, which will turn me again for a 360, and then I do a little bit of a kick out to get my skis parallel with each other again.
A kick out. That's his signature move, and he named it himself. Cook is entirely self-taught. He was never interested in competing. He just likes the challenge and energy that ski ballet brings him. He often skis with his kids and grandkids. And though his love of the art form hasn't rubbed off on any of them, his daughter, Zelina Cook, clearly admires him.
I think it's pretty cool. We always enjoyed watching him. We always kind of knew where he was on the slopes also because we could hear people oohing and aahing.
Cook does turn heads when he performs tricks, and it's obvious to everyone who sees him that he skis to the beat of his own drummer.
In the beginning, in particular, when I skied ballet, I would have music in my head that I started to move to that, the rhythm of it, and unlike typical balleting, it was always rock and roll that was going on in my head, but the slower paced rock and roll. Lady, I forget who sings that song even, but lady, you know, da-da-da. And that made the 360s a whole lot easier.
Lady, when you're with me, I'm smiling.
Nowadays, Cook doesn't ski ballet with a soundtrack in his head. He's just trying to get from one move to the next without falling.
The tricks just don't come as easily as they did when I was younger, but now at this point, I occasionally, what? I fell doing that stupid trick. That was a cinch normally.
Still, Cook is incredibly graceful. He says his dad skied well into his 80s, and Cook is hoping he'll be jumping and twirling just as long. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Andy Kubis.
And you're in luck if you'd like to see Ed Cook and others in action. All of the ski ballet videos your heart desires are at AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show and podcast, Trump on Earth. All of those episodes are at TrumpOnEarth.org. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.